Tune in to Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com. Welcome to Copenhagen Daily on Saturday the 12th of December 2009. We're reporting from inside the Bella Centre and we're going to kickstart off today's show with an interview with one of the climate justice fasters who's here in the Bella Centre. Yeah, this is Anna Keenan. So I'm sitting here with Anna Keenan, one of the climate justice fasters. And I think we're on day 36 of the Climate Justice Fast, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So this is my 36th day without food, having drunk only water now for over a month and the occasional teaspoon of salt to keep my nervous system and my brain going.
Okay. And so how is that going? I kind of failed to imagine really how it might feel, the experience. I did a kind of solidarity fast, if you like, on Monday. I know that a lot of the New Life Copenhagen were asking hosts to do that, so I thought I'd give it a go, which may not have been the right day to have done it because it was a very hectic day here, my first day here as well.
Thank you very much for your solidarity fasting with us. We've had hundreds of people around the world joining us for solidarity fasts of 1 or 2 or 3 days, or sometimes up to a week or 2 weeks, and all of those little bits of support and energy and love that people are giving us are really helping to keep us going. So yeah, I have to say, in terms of the physical experience of fasting, you know, this is something that I could never have anticipated at the start. You know, of course I've never gone without food for over a month before, but I'm actually feeling maybe at my strongest and my most powerful now than I have ever been before. I feel like this has absolutely been the right thing to do. People are really hearing the moral message of climate change that we have, and we're really connecting well with people. And you know, whether that's the media or whether that's you know, government negotiators that we talk to, or you know, the UN Secretariat here, people are very moved by what we're doing. And I feel that in the climate movement at the moment, we've had all of the intellectual arguments that we possibly can have over the last couple of years. You know, everybody knows all of the arguments from all the different sides now. And what we need is, rather than arguing with our heads, we need to start arguing with our hearts. And so that's what the Climate Justice Fast is really about. I've lost a lot of weight, and it's quite scary. I've lost about 25% of my original body weight now, and that's the time when doctors say that we start to move into a very high risk zone. And so of course I'm very worried about that, but aside from feeling very, very light and weak, I'm actually in extremely good spirits, and you know, my health feels quite good. But the doctors warned me that, you know, risks could come at any time, so I am worried about that.
Okay. Could you elaborate on what the risks are and how that impacts? I mean, I guess the first thing that happens is the body uses its fat resource up and then starts to draw on other materials.
Yeah, so after the first few days of fasting, the body like sort of drains itself of sugars in the first few days, and then the body enters starvation mode, and at that time it starts to digest both fats and muscles, you know, from like, you know, your legs, your arms, anything that's not really being used. So my shoulders are incredibly thin at the moment, and it also, you know, starts digesting your fat stores. I still have some fat stores on me, which is great, but you know, my muscles are rapidly disappearing. And of course the, you know, the heart is a muscle, and so that's one of the greatest risks, that you know, the heart muscle can deteriorate. So we have been having you know, just check-ins at the doctors. We had an ECG test the other day, and you know, that looks like it's still normal enough, and we're getting our salt levels checked because salts are necessary to maintain, you know, the body's natural functions and the electricity that runs through your body and your nerves and your brain, and you know, just by having potassium and sodium salts we're surviving, which is great, of course. And yeah, I mean, so that's some of the main risk factors. And then there's, yeah, we've been told to watch out for things that, basically things like, you know, losing memory or starting to talk without making sense or eyes going blurry and things like that, but we're not experiencing those symptoms yet, and we hope not to. So, yeah, we'll see.
So there are, I understand there are 5 people that started at the same time as you and they're still going, and one person in Australia has kind of ended his fast recently.
Yeah, so Michael Morfitt in Australia, he's 61 years old and he was a very, very thin man to start with, and after losing 25% of his body weight, he decided to end his fast, and he ended on a very strong note, saying that he felt you know, like it was a very worthwhile thing to do and it was an inspiring action. And he's I believe he's writing a reflection piece on his experiences on the fast, and you can read that soon on climatejusticefast.com. But he decided that he wanted to, you know, to not risk his permanent, you know, health, and he decided he wanted to go on to fight climate change in the future and to continue being an activist. And you know, I certainly know that I've got a lot of activism left in me to give, and the climate activist movement certainly won't be over at Copenhagen, so we will end the fast. You know, this isn't a death threat, and we're not trying to blackmail governments into action, but we still don't know exactly how or when our fast will end and under what circumstances. That's going to depend a lot on what happens here in Copenhagen in the next 10 days, so, or 8 days now. Yeah.
And what do you think the prospects are, the political process?
Copenhagen, I think everybody realises that the solutions to climate change are not going to come from the fancy negotiating texts that they're all writing about and that they've been writing about for 15 years. You know, this is COP15, not COP1. And if you look at the negotiating texts, they're full of holes. No nations can agree on what to put in there. You know, there's huge arguments between nations, and you know, the best thing to come out of COP15 will not be the negotiating text on the final day. We might not even get a negotiating text agreed on the final day, and you know, ultimately anyway, that doesn't matter to me. What I believe COP15 is an opportunity to engage both the global public and global leaders, world leaders, with this issue in a very intense and a very moral way. The world leaders today need to recognise that they are, you know, at the top of this sort of political hierarchy, and they happen to be there at the moment when climate change is the most urgent issue ever to face the planet, and therefore they have a responsibility to make it their number one priority. We're at the moment when government priorities need to shift from being you know, GDP growth at all costs and this neoliberal paradigm that we've been in for the last 30 years. We need to shift that paradigm very rapidly into the era where sustainability is our top priority, and that's social sustainability, environmental sustainability, you know, climate sustainability, all of these sorts of things, and global equity, and you know, reforming our economic system so that they're no longer unjust. And you know, a lot of people who share this opinion that we need to shift away from neoliberal paradigms, they bring with it an anarchist paradigm that says that, you know, governments are causing the problem, so we need to get rid of governments. I personally disagree with that. I think that governments are very necessary and that we need to work with them, and that governments need to assist in leading this transition, because let's face it, not everybody in society shares these views, and we need governments to lead people who are unable to make these sorts of, you know, grassroots decisions on their own because they've never been exposed to these political analyses. Yeah. So I think that this is a great opportunity to engage world leaders in the need for that paradigm shift. And at the same time, COP15 is an opportunity to capture the public's imagination worldwide to make sure that, you know, the climate message gets out beyond the climate movement and reaches into the broader, more mainstream population. And so if we can achieve that in the next 8 days, then I'm going to be very happy with the results of COP15.
What kind of media exposure have you had? Presumably it's kind of really moved up a gear since the COP has started.
We've actually received a huge response on the media from Climate Justice Fast. You know, it's not like we're front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post and, you know, all of that sort of stuff, but we've been getting a lot of local coverage in different countries. We've been like the top news item in Turkey and Sweden, you know, and sort of different countries around the world have really picked up on the news. We've been definitely in the international news quite strongly, like in China and Korea and Japan and all sorts of things like that. So we're getting good international coverage. And then also in Australia, because we've got Fast's base there, and in the US, you know, we're definitely getting our message out there. And I feel like the Climate Justice Fast has given us a great opportunity to do a lot of authentic communication. A lot of the other communications work that I've done over the last few years has been put through an NGO lens, where I've got my key messages and my key policy points to put across. But with Climate Justice Fast, I can just talk about the need, like I am now, you know, for a true, deep political and cultural shift. You know, this isn't just about words in negotiations. It's not just about policy. It's about a total transformation of society. And you know, that's the message that we're getting out. People are listening.
I guess a lot of people are fearful of big change. Do you have a positive view of change in the future?
Sure, absolutely. I think that if I didn't have a positive vision for change, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. A lot of people, I think, in the climate movement, and I've certainly fallen into this trap myself in the past, it's, we talk about what we can't have in the future and what we need to move away from. We need to stop fossil fuels, stop deforestation, we need to stop consuming, we need to, you know, blah, 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 blah. But one of the things that I've really thought about deeply, and I've had a lot of time to reflect during the fast, has been about what sort of world I want. And in 2050, when I'm 65 years old, I always like to think, you know, in those sort of future terms, at the end of this fight, what are we going to end up with? And I think it's going to be a world where people don't entertain themselves on the weekend by going to the shopping mall and consuming shit they don't need. You know, it's going to be a world where we don't aspire to have bigger cars and bigger houses and bigger flat screen TVs. I think that we're going to go through a cultural change where people are going to learn to be happy with enough, where we realise that, you know, greed is one of the seven deadly sins, and we move forward into a world where we can start to celebrate culture and arts and sports and the richer things in life and family and local food, and start to realise how nourishing that is and how healthy that is, how good it is for our bodies as well as for our environment. And we can start to really live in that sort of positive society. So, you know, before the fast, my main hobby is dancing, and I love dancing and health and strength and, you know, my physical body and using it. And I envisage a world where in the future everybody can have the privilege of learning how to dance and to be happy, and that's the sort of world that I want in 2050.
Meanwhile, developing countries have reacted angrily to the EU proposal for finance that came out of the EU Heads of Summit meeting yesterday. When you get right down to it, not really much of an offer at all, nothing of substance there. And here's the G77 plus China press briefing yesterday with Decimut Williams from the Association of Small Island States, sitting in with Ambassador Lumumba Diaping of G77 plus China.
On the issue of the financing by European summit, our view is that European leaders are acting as if they were climate skeptics. Fundamentally, they are saying this problem does not exist, and therefore they are providing no finance whatsoever. And let me say this in view of two things. The 10 billion or the 2.5 for 2.5 for the next 3 years has a number of related issues. First of all, it doesn't address the issue of financing in its totality. You need to provide fast-track financing for the short term. You need to provide financing for the medium and the long term. You need equally to address the issue of the mechanisms for offering or dispersing these funds. Moreover, you need to tell us where is this money coming from? Are they part of the ODA being shifted, or are they new monies? I do believe that they are not only insignificant, they actually lead to even more and more distrust on the intentions and the seriousness of the European leaders of addressing climate change. The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom said that the maximum the United Kingdom government will put forward is $500 million. In the very day where it turned out, bankers in London City, a 1 square mile, have pocketed $300 billion. So ask yourself, when Gordon Brown says the cost of inaction as far as climate change is concerned would be irreparable, is he being true to his own utterances, or has he found that it's better for him, in order to be elected for the next term, to act and put the maximum that he thinks that would not make some of the skeptics vote for him? He's the very prime minister whose government allow situations where these bankers almost destroyed the UK economy. The day before yesterday, the reports were saying that there have been negative growth in the UK, or shrinking of UK economy by 4.2%. As the same bankers who have pocketed the $300 billion. So I don't think that there is really any sense of leadership coming out of the United Kingdom nor Europe. This is equally bizarre given that United Kingdom and the rest of the European Union member states receive the most generous support ever given in the world, the Marshall Plan, is staggering amounts of money given to them by the United States, which was then 66% of the global economy. So I do believe that there's a really serious deficit of leadership in Europe. And this brings me to an important issue. I hope that President Obama will act with the same spirit, in the same tradition of Roosevelt that this is a serious threat to humanity and that the millions and billions and trillions of dollars sitting there or being channeled into wars that have no basis.
I'm David Korn with Mother Jones Magazine and PoliticsDaily.com in the United States. The first question is, what do you think would be an adequate level of financing, either in the short term or in the long term? If you can give me numbers for both, or some idea, that'd be good.
On the adequacy of the financing, I think you've already heard. The developing countries have called for an adequate level, commensurate with the need. And that could be quantified as a 1.5% of GDP of the developed countries. That could be quantified as the starting point of the $86 billion that the UN says it's a minimum start. That could be quantified as, you know, various levels. What is adequate has to be responsive to the threat. That's what adequacy means for us. It must be responsive to the damage that is already done. I'll give you one indication, and there are hundreds. What does it cost to rebuild an economy that loses 200% of its GDP from a hurricane that is linked to climate change irregularities? What does it cost to do that for 40 countries who simultaneously in any given period of 6 to 9 months experience that? That's what adequacy means. So we can't sit here today and tell you, give us $1 billion per hour. But we do know that the figures that are coming forward so far are not adequate. They're not adequate. On the question of the 1.5 to 2 degrees, look, as I said, 100 countries have estimated under the umbrella of the IPCC that we need ambitious targets. We are now at 0.8, just about, percent increase in temperature since pre-industrial times, 0.8. Imagine what happens if we triple that to around 2. Where would be the predictability and the survivability of small island states? If we go up to an arbitrary figure, which of 2 and over 2 and near to 2 and close to 2, it means that we will lose some of our islands from Indonesia and the Philippines, from the parts of Australia even, and certainly among the small island states, we will go underwater. There is no doubt about that. We have documentary films that we are showing here. You can see for yourself. So I think some of the delegations need a dose of reality. And we bring that. We bring that reality check. Kiribati does not have a clean drinking water supply because of the intrusion of salt water as a result of the rising sea level. And we can give you many examples. We will not be able to guarantee our destruction.
Thank you. Let me just give you the figures that Africa put forward as necessary to address the climate change. Africa is of the view that the two stretches of financing that are needed, immediate, short term, fast track financing for the next 5 to 6 years. And that is equivalent of 1% of the GNP of developed countries. That is the equivalent of $400 billion. That is really the bottom line in terms of addressing the four critical elements: the mitigation, the adaptation, the necessary development in finance, in financing technology transfer, and technology development in all areas, including the renewable energy, which is necessary in order to shift our economies from its current carbon-rich to low-carbon base. Over 5 to 6 years, per year. Now, we are of the view that these 400 billions could be provided by a mixture of public finance sources from developed countries and special drawing rights, of which there are currently 283 unused, sitting or lying in the IMF as reserves. If it was possible to issue $250 billion for the financial crisis, I think it should be possible to issue more for this climate change crisis. The second element necessary in this is the issue of the long term, all the way up to 2050. And we do believe that that will require about 5% of the global, five minimum of the global GMP. Why is that necessary? Because you need to transform the entirety of your economic base. If you do not put the money in order to move and build a greener economy, you're simply going to get the situation worse and worse. I keep saying a simple, and I repeat this issue. If you have an infested a school in your neighborhood or your own house infested by or damaged by anything, what is the typical cost of repair? It's not less than 30%. Now, if the world is really damaged, and we do accept that it is, and that is a continuous and escalating problem, why are we denying the use when billions and trillions are being channeled into the defense industry or the defense budget? Which war is more important than the one against climate change?
Today there are some 5,000 demonstrations, I understand, in around 150 countries around the globe to try and put stronger action for climate change on the agenda and say that people care. And people are travelling from across the world into Copenhagen for a weekend of marches. There's an event called The Flood today, organised principally by Friends of the Earth, and which will flow through the city. And here's a report filed for Copenhagen Daily about some of the people that are travelling on the train.
My name is Irene Brandt, and I've travelled all the way from Malapo, which is a very small village in the northwest of Scotland. I went to see the school children there before I came, and they sent messages which I'm going to deliver to the world leaders. Messages from the children saying that they're concerned about climate change. It will take me 3 days to get there. I travelled from Ullapool and one day to Glasgow, stayed overnight in Glasgow, and then came from Glasgow in the train to London, and now we're going on the rest of our way to Brussels, first of all, and then on to Copenhagen. And it'll be the same on the way home, 3 days. 6 days journeying for 2 days in Europe. But it's worth the effort because I have to do it. It's very important for everybody and for the children.
Thank you for travelling with Eurostar today.
This is a message that Stephen Whitelock, who's aged about 10, wrote. I think it's very cute. Dear world leaders, please stop cutting down trees as they are very good at keeping carbon dioxide out of the air. I also think that you should persuade rich countries like Luxembourg to give money to countries like Africa or Brazil. Finally, I would like to say, watch less TV. Who cares who wins the FIFA World Cup? The reason why I'm writing this letter is because I don't want to wake in heaven. Think of the children. Yours sincerely, Stephen Whitelock.
Okay, my name's Duncan McLaren. I'm travelling from Scotland with 35 activists from Friends of the Earth Scotland to join the Friends of the Earth International Flood for Climate Justice. On Saturday we will be gathering in the city and flooding into Parliament Square in a demonstration designed to draw attention to the lack of justice in the current framework, and in particular the injustices in carbon offsetting, the tricks whereby people in the rich world pay for indulgences rather than actually cutting their emissions at home.
I'm John Elliott from Duns in the Scottish Borders. For me, it's important to go to Copenhagen to be with all the other activists. I'm going there as a member of Friends of the Earth Scotland, but it's important to be going with the others from the other organisations who jointly are trying to make our planet more more environmental justice, more people justice, more economic justice.
This is Climate Radio, I'm Frederica Whitehead, and I'm in the carriage which contains activist groups from Belgium, and ironically we're just passing through Belgium, we've just gone through Liège, it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm going to talk to you. Can you tell me where you're from and what you're doing in Copenhagen?
We're from Belgium, from Ghent, and now we're going to Copenhagen to take part in some protests, because we think it's very urgent that there is action for climate to combat climate change. We're from ENM, it's a youth movement, Youth for Nature and Environment. It's a Belgian organization. In the GNM, we've been working a long time around climate and climate change. We had parties and stuff to finance our trip to Copenhagen, so we were very active.
And the reason why we are on this train is just because it's the most ecological way to travel. It's not the cheapest way. We could have gone by bus or by car. It would have been much cheaper. But we do this because we really feel that everybody should travel more by train. And other guys from our youth organization, they even travel by bike, by go-kart, by hitchhiking, so we really want to do this ecologically.
There is a go-kart on his way with four people, and somebody is driving aside it with a normal bike, and you can follow them on Facebook, and they started their journey 3 weeks ago, and they just wanted no emission to go there. A lot of people of our movement are hitching right now. There are some people at the channel, and they're everywhere, but trying to go as a CO minus as they can. A lot of people just what climate top is that now? I didn't know. Everybody should know, and everybody should know why we are traveling to there right now.
Thank you. I'm still in the Belgian carriage of the train, and I've just met a lady called Little Shiva, who is wearing a fantastic cat outfit. Polar bear. Oh, It's a polar bear. It's not a cat. It's a polar bear. It's white. It's crocheted. It goes over her face, and it has a little black nose and some sunglasses and some big ears. And it's made out of
plastic bags.
It's made out of plastic bags.
Plastic bags.
And can you tell me how you made it?
Yes. I take plastic bags and I cut them so that they become a single thread. And you can find out how to do this on my website, visibletrash.net. And anyway, on visibletrash.net, there's a clip of me showing you how to do this. And so I crochet. Basically, I don't encourage people to use plastic bags. You should take your own bag to the store. But since there are lots of plastic bags lying around, there's always bags you can find or trash you can pick up and do something with. I make costumes with it.
Okay, and I can see here you are teaching all the people around you how to crochet, which is fantastic. It's a very long journey, and there are going to be some beautiful crocheted outfits at the end of it, looking at what's going on around here. Can I ask you what you're going to be doing when you're in Copenhagen and who you're travelling with?
I'm travelling with my friends of the LCR, which is the Ligue Communiste Révolutionnaire. It's the Belgian, it's what the NPA became. The NPA in France used to be LCR, and my Belgian friends are revolutionary communists, and that's who I'm travelling with.
Thank you. Hello. Can you explain to me what you're wearing? Can you describe what you're wearing?
It's a
big white chef's hat. And on your apron, can you tell me what it says on your apron?
It says that the earth is boiling, and we are asking who is the chef, so who is going to take control of the problem, because we don't have a lot of time before the earth will... We don't know what will happen, but we sure know that we don't have a lot of time left. And so we are asking who is the chef. And actually, we already know the answer, because we know that everyone is the chef a little bit. But some people, the people that are now in Copenhagen... might do a little more than we can, so we are giving a message: take your responsibility and do what you have to do.
Okay. And can you tell me where you've come from today?
We're from Belgium, from Flanders, from all over Flanders, and we are we are all young people, and we have done a lot of sessions before this to discuss what we think is important and what where we stand for and where we want to stand for. And then we decided to come here with 15 of us to give our message to the world.
So what will you be doing in Copenhagen this weekend in your lovely aprons?
We will do what has been organized in the Klima Forum, and we might try to see something of the city and try to spread the word, really.
Thank you. Are you optimistic? Do you know what the Belgian delegation... Do you have confidence in the Belgian delegation? Do you have confidence in a positive outcome for the Copenhagen talks?
Yeah, we try to be optimistic about it, because whatever comes out, it will be better than what is happening now. And we hope that it's a lot better, but we can only hope and be optimistic, because if we are negative about this, we won't get any farther.
Thank you very much. This is Climate Radio. It's about 5:15. I'm somewhere in Germany on the Copenhagen Express, and I've just met Helen in coach 10. Helen, how old are you?
I'm 9 years old, 10 tomorrow.
You're 10 tomorrow?
Yeah.
And what are you going to be doing on your 10th birthday?
Well, there's a march, so they'll be shouting, and then we'll be sleeping in a school, I think.
And why are you going to Copenhagen?
Because there's going to be a big meeting about what they're going to do about climate change, and it's very important, because if they don't do something, they'll destroy some of the animals.
And what's this you've got with you?
this is a polar bear, which we take on when it marches, because polar bears can be affected very badly.
And what do you want the world leaders to do in the big meeting?
I want them to listen to what most people, to what we are saying, and try and do what they can to save the world.
Thank you, Helen. That was lovely. People seem to have woken up, they've had their dinner. It was quite rowdy in the middle of the afternoon. Now it's sort of gentle post-dinner chat. There's a lot of very deep, meaningful conversations going on, and they're also starting to serve bottles of wine. The music that was very loud earlier has become more mellow, and there's a lot of conversation. This is Climate Radio. It's 6:30 local time. I'm somewhere between Minden and Hamburg, and I've just met a group of people that are travelling with Oxfam. Can I ask you why you're going and about your trip to Copenhagen?
Well, I was in Kyoto in 1997 inside the negotiations, and after 12 days there we managed to get kind of one word in the protocol on equity, but our hopes were dashed when all these mechanisms were created to create the clean development mechanism and the carbon markets. And now, 12 years later, there isn't any tangible difference out there in the world. So I'm going to Copenhagen as part of this incredible international growth of this international movement that's come together, which we didn't have in Kyoto. And I'm going with Oxfam to push and to hold to account our negotiators inside that there is this whole international movement pushing for action.
Okay. I just want listeners to get a little sense of the process. You said that when you went to Kyoto, you managed to get one word into the treaty, but then that was shot by the Clean Development Mechanism. Did the Clean Development? So were you happy? Was there a moment when you were happy with the treaty, and then it changed again?
Let me be clear. No, I was working for Globe, the network of parliamentarians around the world. And we were working with Aubrey Mayer to get contraction and convergence advocated within the United Nations framework on climate change. And after a seminar for the key negotiators in Japan, in Kyoto, and then 11 days of negotiating, we were encouraging the Europeans to be negotiating on the basis of the best way to manage greenhouse gas emissions is on the basis of equity between countries. We did finally get the one word equity into the Kyoto Protocol. But after 11 days and a big team of people, all volunteers and some of us paid, it was frustrating just to get the word equity in there. But the main focus of the Kyoto Protocol was the clean development mechanism and the opportunity for the carbon markets. And it was a feeling like, you know, after all the work we've done to try to get the world to come together to realise the most democratic fair way is what Aubrey Mayer calls contraction and convergence, where we in the developed countries begin to contract our emissions to allow China and India and others to increase their emissions per capita, and with that, then we start to converge together, and then we can start to bring them down.
Can you explain to me how you as a group managed to get the word equity in? Say I'm Joe Bloggs and I want, and I have a concept such as equity, would radically change a treaty or an agreement. How did you set about getting that word put in?
It took about a year because we are a network of parliamentarians and we had many discussions among parliamentarians, not just in Europe but also the US, Japan and Russia. And then we had a parliamentarian meeting in Tokyo before meeting in Kyoto, where we had unanimity among our parliamentarian members. Meanwhile, we'd also pushed and lobbied the European Union negotiating panels and member states, and they were aware of contraction and convergence, I'd commission a film explaining what it was about, so they'd all seen it. And then we had a special one-day seminar just for the key negotiators, hosted by the Japanese government, where we looked at the ideal way of sharing it equitably, fairly between nations. So they were aware of us, but it took a year in planning. It was working with individual members of parliament in member states. It was working with the European Parliament. It was working with the US Congress, the Japanese Diet, and then the Russian Duma. The Russians were more democratic than they are now. So we had a group, a network of parliamentarians, and we were working sort of day in, day out, giving them papers, motions in parliament, bringing agendas for action, and getting really publicising what Globe was calling for, so that when we got to Kyoto, if you like, we kind of done the work as a good campaigning body, but we were nonetheless kept pushing our message. And my boss at the time then gave a speech to the Kyoto climate change discussions on the basis of equity. And finally, on the, you know, the last I think the second to last day, we finally learned about 2 a.m. they've accepted it. Equity, it goes into the protocol as an ideal way of greenhouse gas emission management. But actually, it wasn't. You know, it was just in the protocol, but it wasn't the main thrust. It wasn't the main focus.
Okay, I realise I didn't ask you your name. Ken, I'm so very impressed that such an important you managed to get such an important word into the treaty. So I'm very excited, very interested to know what you're trying to get into this treaty, because we were just talking about Kyoto, so now obviously this is Copenhagen, and now you were working for Globe and now you're working for Oxfam. Can you tell me your name, your job, and what you're trying to do in the Copenhagen treaty?
My name is Chris Le Breton. I'm a volunteer with Oxfam, and I'm not now in touch with the negotiators. I'm not in that field. But I think where it's at is outside with peoples of the world. Compared to Kyoto, the fact there are so many NGOs, and both in Copenhagen already and coming by train and from around the world, this is different. There wasn't the pressure of the world in Kyoto. We knew we were representing coming from our different countries, but this is different. I think we also need more radical measures. Just negotiating about climate change on its own is too limiting, too restrictive, and we lose the plot. We're damaging the world's planet so much in terms of our biodiversity, in terms of pollutions to waters, in terms of waste, and our ecological footprints are devastating. Climate change is just one aspect, and we've got to look at all entirety. Otherwise, we risk being ineffective. And I think the longer term is we've got to find a way of running our world without all this growth, and actually get down to one planet living. And I'm going just to listen to the incredible youth out there. They've got the ideas. I'm in my 40s now. They've got some brilliant ideas. Sooner I'll be handing over the chalice, the banner to them. But I'm going along to be with them, support them, to be outside. We've got to keep our spirits. We can, it's people power that always has one. And this time I want to be outside and listen, learn, and let's be mindful and let's intuit that we can get change.
Thank you very much. It's about 8 o'clock and the train is absolutely packed. Everybody's standing up and lots of people are moving around and chatting, and it's a very, very sociable atmosphere. And I've just found Abby Edgar, who's one of the organisers of the British contingent. Abby, how many people are on this train?
There's about 700. We brought 130 from the UK, and we joined up with a group from France, which mostly consisted of Amis la Terre, which is French Friends of the Earth, and a group from Belgium, which is mainly trade union groups. It was organised over the course of the past year when we attended, as part of our global climate campaign, attended meetings with activists from all over Europe, primarily in Copenhagen and Brussels. And it came from the idea that we wanted to transport as many people as possible to Copenhagen for the demonstration on the 12th. So working with our Belgium and French contacts, we're really pleased that it came together and they were able to charter a train to the Belgium train network and things.
It's a really fantastic achievement. Everyone's having so much fun. There's one question I have to ask. What time do you think we're going to arrive in Copenhagen?
I would like to say we'll arrive at midnight, but we've been told we could arrive as late as 2 a.m. I'll leave it, fingers crossed.
Just another 5 hours to go then.
Thanks. Thanks, Abby. I'll go down there and have a chat to some more people.
Okay, this is take three of the Climate Express. Are the Climate Chorus ready? Okay. Take the Climate Express when the world's in a mess 'cause of CO2. We're off to Copenhagen, a protest we'll be staging. You can join us too. Denmark's easy to get to, easier than Kyoto. It'll be a blast. But as the Antarctic sinks and those atolls they sink, we better get there fast. Well, let me say, ba 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 ba. Oh yeah. Uh-huh. All right. We're going where the air is free. Ba da ba ba da da. On the Climate Express, there's a jolly hostess selling vegan sandwiches. An acoustic guitar and a harmonica and songs in lots of languages. From all parts of the earth, the activists will converge by land and sea. The only difficult bit is how are we going to fit in such a small country? Let me say ba 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 da ba. Uh-huh. All right. Oh yeah. We're going where the air is free. Uh-huh. Tomorrow belongs to me. Will the temperatures rise by 6 degrees? Will the Gulf Stream stop and we'll all freeze? We can stop it if we protest. Take a trip on the Climate Express. Oh yeah. All right. All right. A Climate Express. A Climate Express. Yes, yes. A Climate Express. Climate Express. A Climate Express. A Climate Express. A Climate Express. A Climate Express.
At the end of each day at the UN Climate Talks, the largest NGO grouping, the Climate Action Network, gives an award called the Fossil of the Day to the country that it considers has done the most to hamper the progress of the talks. And Canada, so far, is pretty much out in the lead for getting most of the awards. At last night's ceremony, third place was taken by the European Union, and I'll quote from the press release. It says, European leaders had the chance to put their mark on the talks today by agreeing a more ambitious ambitious 2020 target, by putting money on the table longer term, by ensuring short-term finance is new money, and by closing EU loopholes like hot air and sinks. Five opportunities for leadership. Of the five, they took zero. Second place was awarded to Canada. And again, quoting from the press release, Canada's chief negotiator insisted in a briefing this morning that his country's target of minus 3% below 1990 is, in fact, based on science. The price quote in answer to a question was, "Yes. Canada's targets are science-based? Absolutely, yes." And first place also went to Canada. It doesn't get much clearer than this. Canada's Environment Minister, Jim Prentice, said yesterday that, quote, "It's in Canada's interest to replace the Kyoto Protocol with a new agreement." He didn't explain whether that's because he's scared to face Kyoto Compliance Committee. Basically, Canada has overshot massively its Kyoto Protocol target for the first commitment period. And there is some kind of compliance mechanism within the Kyoto Protocol. It's considered not to be strong enough, but it would certainly impact on Canada, and therefore Canada has been leading the call to kill the Kyoto Protocol and move towards the non-binding agreement that is also favoured by the US and others. The awards ceremony last night was capped off with this little song that ends today's Copenhagen Daily. Tune in again on Monday now. There's actually been a lot of developments with new texts put on the table, which we will be bringing you detail about. It's a lot to digest and make sense of. We'll be speaking to people that will help us do that. So tune in again. Thanks for listening.
Tonight, in recognition of Canada's special, I don't want to say the word achievements, specialness, we're going to special status, thank you, a special status as now, by a wide margin, the top obstructor of progress at the global climate talks. We're going to end with a special song about Canada itself.
Daily, every day, from 11 a.m. till noon, throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.